Let's begin with our motivation. Here we are in the situation of retreat, having ample time to digest the Dharma and to put it into practice, and to look at our mind and really understand the way our mind functions. So at this time, when we're doing more intense practice, then our mind tends to become much more open and the teachings go in a lot deeper, whether we listen to them or read or whatever, because our mind usually has fewer distractions. So it's very good to take advantage of this time and listen to teachings, do some study, contemplate the meaning, and really make use of the precious time that through a lot of previous causes we've been able to experience the result of having the time now to do this, and also having all the cooperative conditions, many of them provided by other people. And so to remember, as we do retreat, even if we're not in retreat, that we're very related to all other living beings. And so it's really imperative that our Dharma practice include within its scope the welfare of other living beings. Because after all, we're dependent on them. They've done so much for us. So in a way, it's the least we could do to try and repay their kindness. Not to mention the fact that they're taking rebirth under the influence of afflictions and karma, and just like us being miserable in that process. And so the wish to alleviate their misery, trying to progress along the path to attain the realizations that we need to be of the most effective benefit. Okay, so keep your highest aspiration in mind as much as you can throughout the retreat, and especially before beginning any session. So I was thinking of, you know, how many sentient beings are experiencing all sorts of things today. Up and down, good and bad, happy or unhappy. And how most of them have not encountered the Dharma and have no ability to really make a lot of sense of their experience, you know. But most people just feeling like, okay, I'm just trying to keep my head above water and have as much happiness as I can and hope for the best, but not having any idea of how to create the causes of happiness or avoid the causes of suffering. Not really having any reliable refuge to turn to who can teach them and instruct and guide them. And so just kind of going along, like I said, hoping for the best, thinking, I've got to help myself and get as much happiness as possible. That's the way to do it. And yet, actually, that's the way that brings all the problems, is just by thinking about ourselves. So, you know, when you really look at the situation, and not in an abstract way, this is the situation of most of our family members. You know, most of the people that we grew up with, we care the most about, or our colleagues who, you know, and friends whose lives were really intertwined with them. You know, this is exactly their situation. This isn't some kind of abstract phenomena, you know, of other people, but it's with the very people that we know and care about. And how strange it is, you know, wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, yet often being very resistant to creating the causes of happiness. You know, sometimes we try and encourage people, oh, be generous, or, you know, come on, don't cheat that person, you know, you can charge them less, or whatever it is. You know, and people being really resistant, even when we try and encourage them to do something virtuous. Yeah? And it's not because they're bad people, you know, it's just that they're ignorant, yeah? In a Dharma sense, even though they may be incredibly smart in terms of university and professional degrees. You know, they have tons of diplomas on their wall, but in terms of the Dharma, you know, not much knowledge or wisdom. Okay, so, you know, really considering that this is their situation. And also, in a way, it's our situation, because every time we space out, every time we just jump into our usual way of being, chasing the eight worldly concerns, then we're exactly the same, you know, having no refuge, wanting happiness and creating the causes of suffering, thinking that working only for our own benefit is the way to do it, when actually that's the wrong way to do it. Yeah, so there's no reason to kind of hold ourselves apart and think that we're so holy, you know, we're not. Yeah. But the little that we know does give us perspective and a capability and an opening that is really miraculous when you think of what all of samsara is. Okay? And so really taking advantage of that and really including everybody else in our motivation. Because after all, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas included us in their motivation. Yeah? I mean, can think about it. You know how sometimes somebody does something in this life that just really shakes you up and you just get a very strong Dharma motivation because of it? Somebody does something really completely off the wall and it really shakes you up and you go, I'm never going to do that. I'm really going to, you know, kind of tame my mind. Now just think, maybe in a previous life, we were that person that sparked that intention from somebody who's now a Bodhisattva. You know, we did something outstandingly stupid. You know, extraordinarily harmful. Yeah, we're not beyond that, are we? Yeah? And yet the Bodhisattvas didn't kind of look at us and go, what a pain in the neck this one is. Yeah. No, they really, you know, generated more compassion for us. So, you know, similarly for us to do that towards others. It's only natural, isn't it? Okay. So we've been doing this chapter in Aryadeva's text about preparing, the chapter 8 about preparing the disciple for the teachings on emptiness. So I just wanted to review the last verse, because that last verse, I don't know, a lot of these verses are really powerful, but that last one, okay, so the last verse said, whatever contains, well, it was a question, that somebody asks. If things are empty, it's appropriate to teach suchness or emptiness. What is the use of teaching how the world of sentient beings and environments came into existence? So this person's saying, why do we need to learn the 12 links of dependent arising? Why do we need to learn how karma works? Yeah, if understanding emptiness is the key to liberation, why don't we just go directly to that? So Aryadeva says, whatever contains teaching about the world speaks of engagement. Whatever contains elucidation of the ultimate speaks of disengagement. And so there he's talking about when you have teachings on the conventional truths, yeah, like the 12 links of dependent arising that talk about how we take rebirth in cyclic existence. Okay, the teachings about the afflictions and what causes them and what are the conditions for their arisal. You know, all these kinds of teachings are really important because without understanding them, it's going to be very difficult for us to understand emptiness. Okay? And so in specific, Geltsabje, who wrote the commentary to Aryadeva's text, was saying that when you learn the 12 links of dependent arising, it's a prelude for learning about emptiness because it already begins to challenge some of our very gross misconceptions. Okay. And we are full of misconceptions. So in particular, it challenges three of them. One, that our lives are produced by a creator, an external creator. Two, that our lives are just causeless and random. And three, what was the third one? That they're produced by a discordant cause, by something that doesn't really have the ability to produce them, such as, you know, a primal substance, or we're all part of a universal cosmic mind, or something like that. Okay? So, if you look in the world, we have a lot of these ideas, you know? Most of us, you know, may have grown up with this idea of some kind of creator, you know. When you say, Mommy and Daddy, why am I alive? You know, that, well, God made you. Yeah. Who's God? Yeah. Well, and they say something. Yeah. Yeah, it used to be that old guy with a beard in the sky, but then feminism came along and they couldn't say it anymore. Then they had to say something else. Yeah? But how many of us at some level feel, oh, there's some external creator who made my life and made everything around, you know? And that creator is maybe permanent. You know, when we were taught about God, we asked, where did God come from? Well, nowhere. God always was. Okay, so something that always was isn't caused by causes and conditions, so it must mean it's permanent. It never changes. Okay, so we said, oh, okay, then there's this permanent thing that never changes, but it created me, and it created everything else. And when you're a kid, okay, you kind of accept that. And then when you hit teenage years, you know, you start to ask questions. Yeah? Like, well, you know, I mean, I just remember myself, well, how can God create things if nobody created God? You know, at that time I had no awareness of Buddhist philosophy. But now, looking back on that, that was a really good question. Because I was actually saying, how can something that exists without being produced by a cause, produce an effect? Actually, it's impossible. if something, you know, to produce, to create something involves change. Yeah? So if God changes, then God isn't permanent. It's not permanent, okay? Which means that God is influenced by causes and conditions. Which means that, gee, what I was taught doesn't hold water. Okay? Yeah. Or as I was saying last time, this was my puzzle as a teenager growing up in the middle of the Vietnam War. Why did God create war? Yeah? I mean, if you're all-powerful, you can make anything happen. Why do you create war and suffering? Why? You know? It's just... couldn't make any sense of that. Yeah? Could you make any sense of that? You know? It just was like a blank on the screen. Huh? I just don't get it. Yeah? So when we learn about the 12 links of dependent arising and we start getting an idea of how everything that functions and arises due to causes and conditions, then we see that there can't be some kind of permanent creator. And there can't be some manager of the universe who takes care of everything that is not affected by causes and conditions. Because anything that changes means it's affected by causes and conditions, which means it's under the power of others, which means it can't be omnipotent and, you know, independent and create whatever it wants, independent of causes and conditions. Okay? So, you know, that's one reason for teaching about, you know, the 12 links and how samsara works and why, how afflictions arise and these kinds of things. So that's one wrong view that, you know, we need to really spend some time thinking about and really, you know, get rid of that in our mind. Yeah? Because if we don't, then there's one part of our mind that's kind of, well, if this Buddhism doesn't work out, I can always go back. Mm-hmm. You know? But I think, did I tell you last week? My friend Alex Berzin, who teaches, somebody came to him once and said, but it's, you know, if I'm a Buddhist, then I might go to Christian hell, but if I go back to being a Christian, I might go to Buddhist hell. Yeah? That's confusion. That's confusion. Okay. Yeah? So... So these kinds of ideas, I mean, we really need to think deeply, and, you know, is that possible? Yeah. Is that possible? Does such a thing exist? Yeah. What makes somebody go to hell? Yeah. Does Buddha send anybody to hell? Buddha has many better things to do. Yeah. Anyway, Buddha can't send us to hell. In fact, even our enemies can't send us to hell. No other sentient beings, no matter how many times they say to us, go to hell, none of them can send us to hell. Seriously, the only thing that can send us to hell is our self-grasping ignorance and our self-centered mind. Those are the two things that can send us to hell. No external being, no human being, no matter what somebody awful thing somebody says to you, does to you, none of them can send you to hell. Because nobody else makes us create the negative karma, which is the cause. Only our self-grasping mind, only our self-centered mind. It's the only thing. Yeah? Okay? So really thinking about this, can you see how, you know, if you start thinking about cause and effect and how samsara is created and so on, how it really it takes you away from this idea of some kind of external creator, who it was always rather puzzling, you know, that, you know, God's compassionate, yet, he certainly punishes people, whereas in Buddhism there's no idea of reward and punishment. But what do you have to do to please God? Because as a kid, you would sometimes see people doing what they told you to do to please God, and yet they were unhappy. Yeah, this whole thing of why do bad things happen to good people? Yeah? And exactly what were the rules? Yeah? Okay, if there's rules here, I want to play by them so I can be on God's good side, but they tell me these rules, but I can't see them always working. Yeah. Okay, so really, it's a whole meditation on causes and conditions, isn't it? Yeah. Then another thing, learning about samsara and how ignorance causes karma and causes karma, you know, karma puts imprints on the mind, and then how the mind is reborn due to craving and grasping and so on. Okay, studying that whole sequence. It also helps us to see that our lives and our misery are not accidental. They're not random. They're not causeless. Yeah? Sometimes when you give up the notion of God, then you go into a completely opposite direction and become quite nihilistic. Yeah. Friends of Unje who came last week, the two young people, they were kind of going, you know, well, my faith in God is shattered because my friend died. And they're kind of going towards, well, the universe is just cold and unfeeling and nothing exists and nothing matters anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I said, look, there isn't just those two sides. Yeah, there isn't just those two possibilities. But that's often what happens, you know. That's kind of what happened to me, you know, when I was in college. I gave that up and I just went ballistic, or hedonistic, I should say, because it was like, okay, might as well enjoy. Nothing means anything anyway. It's all random. Yeah? I mean, I always kind of had that conscience, but my conscience when I was younger was more a fear of my mom than anything else. You know? It, like, really took a while for me to develop ethical conduct for its own sake because that was the way I wanted to be. Because so often it was like, if my mom found out what I was doing, you know, that's going to be bad news. So that's not a very good reason for holding ethical conduct. Did any of you have? Yeah?
It's probably why we're still alive, though.
Yes, it's true. We may still be alive because, you know, our mother or father in our mind saying, don't you dare do this, instilled a little bit of fear in us. Sometimes. Sometimes we went and did the exact opposite, didn't we? Yeah. Don't tell me what to do. Anyway, we, you know, by doing this contemplation, again, we find that our lives and our suffering are not causeless. They're not random. They're not just, you know, neurons blipping in our brain. They're not just genetically controlled. I mean, even the ideas of gene, there's some kind of idea of cause. But, you know, still, well, actually, that belongs to the third one, the discordant one. But anyway, just this whole idea of, you know, nothing. There's no reason for anything happening. You know, it's just luck. Yeah? And much of samsara, you know, living in society seems like that, doesn't it? You know, it's luck, what family you're born into, which influences so much the opportunities we have in our life. So it seems like a lot causeless. So then we don't think of, well, anything like, well, you know, if there are causes, what should I do to create more causes to experience the good results I have? Or if we have suffering, what should I avoid so I don't create these kind of causes again? Yeah, we just go into some nihilistic kind of vacuum of hedonism. Yeah. So, but really, again, thinking about how samsara evolves cuts that out. So that's something else. You know, if we're going to realize emptiness, we have to get rid of that idea that things come about without a cause. Yeah. And then the third thing is that things come about because of discordant causes. Okay. So we're all products of one universal mind. Really? Yeah. We come out of that mind and dissolve into it, or we're products of one universal substance, we're born from that and dissolve into it. Those kinds of things don't exist, so those are discordant causes. Or even the way society is going. You know, I think that, yes, our body and our neurons and our genes, yes, they have some influence over our mind and our experience. That's clear. But as a society, we tend to be going towards giving biology and brain neurology and so on more and more and more power in our explanation of why we experience the things that we do. And I think in a way this is very disempowering, because it alleviates us of personal responsibility, because we can say, why am I an alcoholic? It runs in the family. Yeah. Why do I have a hot temper? Well, you know, it's genetic. And I think that that kind of perspective, when we just put everything on genes or everything on brain chemistry, can be very, very dangerous, because then we abdicate personal responsibility. Yeah. And nowadays, everybody has a psychological diagnosis. Yeah? You're abnormal if you don't have something wrong with you. It's kind of true, isn't it? You know? I mean, you look in the... They've added, I don't know how many new disorders to the psychological diagnostic tools, number 5. I mean, all these new disorders. I know it's like everybody has to have a disorder. And I know one family, the mother's diagnosed everybody in the family, including herself. You know, this one has this disorder, that one suffers from that. This one, you know? And so it all basically becomes meaningless, doesn't it? Yeah. And then we say, well, I have this disorder. It's because my serotonin, my dopamine, my whatever it is, I have too many branches in my neurons, not enough branches in my neurons. So that's why I have this. So,
medicate me.
Yeah, medicate me. Medicate me. Yeah? I'm depressed, I'm unhappy, I have no responsibility for the way I think. Just give me a pill. Yeah? So I'm not saying everybody thinks like that. But what I'm saying is that there's a tendency now to put everything on the body. And I don't think that that is realistic. Yeah? And I think it's actually kind of dangerous. And I saw the doctor in the audience nodding in agreement. Yeah.
We should label it, then people don't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
You have diabetes, and it's okay. Right? Now I have a pill, and I'm good.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
You have this process.
Yeah.
That's very dangerous. Call pointing a bone.
What?
Point the bone. The doctor points a finger at you, so you have 3 months to live, and maybe 3 months to live.
Yeah.
It's crazy. In fact, it's illegal in Australia to point the bone, to point the finger.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a witch doctor thing. You point the bone, you're going to die. The mind goes crazy.
Yeah.
Very powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Labeling things like that.
Labeling, yep. Yep.
Well,
feel like all those psychological disorders you're talking about, like, it also ignores neuroplasticity. I feel like that's why the Dalai Lama is so interested in that sometimes. Like our brain changes all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, our brain is changing. But also, our mind can make our brain change. And maybe we change not so much because our brain is changing, but because our mind is changing.
Mm-hmm. Look at patterns.
Yeah.
Look at electrical activity in the brain.
Uh-huh.
At age 21 to 22, you sort of just create the same pattern for the rest of someone's life. Mm-hmm. Every time you're stuck in a rut. And you think different thoughts, but they're the same ignorance, the same process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you add Buddhism into this process, some a way of thinking, you actually can change that pattern in your brain. They can show you that can happen.
Huh.
So there are ways after, most people are set in the way they think. Uh-huh. There are ways post that time of your age to create a whole new pattern in your brain.
Yep.
To open these things up, but it takes effort. And we don't want to have any effort. We want, like you said, we want a pill.
Yep.
It's easy.
I don't want to have to put out any effort. Yeah.
And I've seen this in my patient base for so long. It's overwhelming to look at this every day.
Yeah.
You go, no, you have to do something different. Well,
they don't want to.
That is the same thing, but with a different label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of chocolate ice cream, have vanilla. How about give up the ice cream, the sugar, and change to something more healthy?
Yeah.
That's something different.
Yeah.
But that's a mind change.
Right.
It's hard for people to do that.
Yeah.
So as a doctor, you say to somebody, I'm not giving you a pill or a diagnosis, I'm going to give you this way of thinking. They look at you as you're crazy. Pain management for 18 years, I mean, pain doesn't start when they come see me.
Mm-hmm.
Pain started way back when they're 30 years old and they thought somebody did something wrong to them and then I was ingrained in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
How do you undo that?
Mm-hmm.
Very frustrating, but I think the way to do it, honestly, is what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Teach the dog.
Yeah.
In very subtle ways, sometimes out there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. It is different because, I mean, also people come to me and I try and say, well, they come to me, I have this problem. And I say, try this way of thinking. And most of them don't. It's like most of them come back. Then again, you know, a week later, a month later, same problem, same thing. What should I do? Well, you know, did you try what I did before? No. Well, I tried it once. But, you know, it's not going to do it.
Just bill your insurance again, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's most doctors think.
So getting rid of these notions that things that can't cause, that have no power to cause a certain effect, can cause that effect. I mean, this is a good idea, what you were just saying about, you know, what happens with doctors and patients is a very good example of it. You know, we want to take refuge in something that actually can't bring about what we want simply because that's easier. Yeah. So, you know, these kinds of meditations, just thinking about causes and conditions on whatever level, and then making it more and more, you know, broadening it out to many, many different aspects of our life, is really, that will provoke some change in us. That will instigate some change. Yeah, and that's really the whole teaching on dependent arising, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, at least the foundation teaching on dependent arising, which is causal dependence. Yeah, and to think, I mean, we all know, okay, you know, sprouts come from seeds and everything like this, but we don't always live our life as if we believed that things come from causes. You know, that have the power to create them. Yeah. So much of our life we live in la-la land, wanting things to happen without creating the appropriate causes. Yeah. So.
I think it's because we can't see You know, I was thinking about this in terms of like just being with my family recently, realizing that I have the family has a whole family concept that we're going to be like our ancestors. You know,
yes.
Like, you know, and so I have spent a lot of my life really working hard not to be like my parents, right? And,
yeah.
And I didn't have to work so hard, but I didn't know that. I mean, because I can't see my mind, right? Mm-hmm. So I can understand, I know what happens when I put a seed in the ground, I can watch that. But I can't necessarily, I don't have the insight or the meditative stability or haven't to trace how my own thoughts are creating the causes for things in the future, right? So that disconnect between understanding cause and effect on a material level is very different on a mental level, right?
Okay, so how's that tying into thinking that you're going to be just like your ancestors?
Well, so there's that kind of also sort of physical thing. Oh, so the father had this thing in his mind, his son has this thing in his mind, his son has this thing in his mind.
Okay.
We can see that.
Uh-huh.
But we can't see the thought where the person, like, changed and went outside the family and did something else. It's harder to find that cause.
Okay.
So it looks discordant.
Okay.
So
what you're saying is that we often think, okay, hereditarily we take on our parents' genes, but also mentally we take on their habits.
Right.
But then you may work very hard to change your mental habits. Yeah. But people don't always see that as having a cause, or they don't know what to do to change their mental habits.
Yes, or even you work really hard and you hope it's going to work, but because you don't understand the causality of things,
okay.
You don't really have confidence in your own capacity to do that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's actually quite a good one.
Isn't the cause connect because of a sense of a permanent eye?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I can look as a biologist and go, there's a seed, there's the plant, and I can study it, and you know, that's where it is. Like Darwin, when he came back from the Galapagos, still went to church and believed in God.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the book this big about evolution, about change. Because we think we're separate from the process. We're separate from everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we give ourselves some higher level or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Or this idea, like you said, that we are permanent. I have this personality. Yeah. And there's nothing I can do to change it. You know, I had this kind of habit, it made me become this kind of person, nothing to do. You know, I'm going to have this problem my whole life, you know, as if the problem didn't have causes, and as if there's no things that we can do to change it. Yeah, we just kind of sign off, well, that's the way I am, you know. We don't give ourselves a chance because we don't understand causality on a mental level, you know. But once you start practicing the Dharma and you can start watching your thoughts and watch how changing your thoughts influences your moods and how influencing your moods influences your behavior and how influencing your behavior influences what you experience, then you begin to see, oh, there's some kind of causality here, even within this life, you know. So then there must be some kind of causal process going on between this life and the next life, which means I can do something. Yeah, I'm not a victim of life. Yeah.
Yeah. Just from an earlier comment, I feel like, you know, it's not... Sometimes we don't want true renunciation to say, oh, I'm going to, you know, give this up, but we don't really. And I thought, because we make excuses or we try to bargain, and then, but I just thought it was interesting how you started to talk with reliable refuge, because if you really understand that, then you wouldn't have to try to, like, have bargaining chips all over the place. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, this whole thing of bargaining, isn't it? Yeah, that comes about through not really understanding the causes of suffering. Yeah. So anyway, that verse Yeah, we're still on last resort. is quite important because it's really emphasizing how important it is to understand conventional truths and the conventional process of causality and cause and effect, specifically not in the biological realm, but in the realm of how, you know, ignorance produces afflictions, which produce karma, which produce rebirth and suffering and so on, and understanding that whole system of causality and how that will get rid of so many of our wrong ideas and how these wrong ideas really keep us very limited now. Because when we have wrong ideas about causality, then we don't create the causes we need to create. Yeah, because we have the wrong ideas. You know, this is why in the Noble Eightfold Path, right view is the first one. It's the first one, and it's also the last one. Because, first of all, to start your Dharma practice, you have to learn about what to do and what not to do. You know, just on a conventional level, I call it stop being a jerk or getting your act together, you know? And it's very basic, but if you do it, it has a big effect. Yeah?
This question relates, if you don't, that's fine. So when we're doing this retreat, and we're doing some of us doing the four establishments of mindfulness, we talk about the body being the source of karmically induced dukkha.
Uh-huh.
The part that I can't make the tie-in with that is I can see the relationship between the body as in the nature of karmically, in the nature of dukkha. Because Geshe, who was here last summer, said that when they talk about in the nature, it means that it leads to, and that's easy for me to see from my own experience, that everything related to the body will lead to something that's unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. But I can't see the link in the 12 links anywhere in my experience to tie that into the karmically produced dukkha. You see what I'm saying?
Not exactly. The karmically produced, why are we born in a body that gets old and sick and dies?
And I don't, that's the part I can't see. I can't see how doing this meditation on the body will help me to see that, because it's all too theoretical.
Oh, okay. So, because you begin to see, because most of us have so much attachment to our body, we love our body. We want to have a body like this. You know, we crave to have a body like this. We don't realize that this body is under the control of afflictions and karma. Okay. When we realize that everything we experience in this body is under the influence of afflictions and karma, then we see that there's no way to ever have lasting happiness with this kind of body.
We have to make that connection to make the link to the 12.
Yeah, because the whole thing is, why do we crave this kind of body? Because, you know, we've created karma. That's in our mind stream. What makes that karma, you know, ripen? Craving and clinging. Mm-hmm. Okay, so why do I crave this kind of body? What is my idea?
Distortions.
Huh?
Pulling those four distortions.
Yeah. I have a totally distorted idea of what this body is and what the value of this body is. And so therefore, at the time of death, just automatically, I want one.
Right.
Yeah? And as they say, be careful what you want because you might get it.
So the part I have to really focus on is
When we say it's in the nature of dukkha, it doesn't just mean it leads to dukkha. It means it's produced by undesirable things like ignorance, afflictions, and karma. So anything, like His Holiness always says, the word ignorance, just the word makes you think of something not very appetizing. Yeah. So something produced out of ignorance isn't very desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So to try and understand, well, how is this body? How did we take this body under the influence of ignorance?
Yeah, I can see how the illusion is so strong in my mind towards my attitude towards having this body right now. So mm-hmm. then I have to just take that and fast forward, you know, into the future, or go back to how I got to here. And
right.
The same thing that I can actually see.
Exactly. The same attachment to the body now was exactly what happened before. Yeah.
I am seeing how it's really hard to... The meditations are so strong. And then I open my eyes and I'm like, there's this great body.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go out and move and do something.
Yeah. And this body's always got to feel happy.
Yeah. I know it's not going to be the same, but it feels so...
Yeah, let's have some pleasure for this body, you know? Yeah. 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 I mean, that's why we say practice Dharma, because you're absolutely right. You can be in meditation and see something so clearly. And as soon as you open your eyes, the mind just goes back to where it was, you know?
And what I read about that said, as long as you're seeing things as truly existent, this is how...
Yeah.
But you still, we can see, we have our minds, but we can see we're doing that.
Yeah, you know, and as we do things again and again and again repeatedly, then even when we come out of our meditation, one part of our mind can start to say, you're not thinking in the correct way, you know, because in your session you saw this very clearly, and that was a wisdom mind, and this one isn't. Yeah, so go back to your wisdom mind and make your decisions based on that. You know? You kind of sit down, have a little chat with yourself. Yeah, nice compassionate chat, but, you know, to activate our wisdom. Okay, shall we try going on to the next verse? Okay. So the next verse is about giving up the fear of emptiness. So here Joe Blow has a question. If all things are empty, there are many unwanted consequences, since by denying the existence of objects, agents, and action, even liberation will not exist. So Joe Blow is saying, okay, if things are empty, then you're denying the existence of people who create karma, the action of creating karma, the object they create the karma with. You're denying the existence of all these things on the conventional level. So then even liberation is impossible. So why do I try? So what is Joe Blow's problem? What's he seeing incorrectly? What's his problem?
He's saying emptiness is nothingness.
Right.
Yeah. He thinks emptiness means nothingness. Okay. And it doesn't. Okay. So, Aryadeva says, thinking nothing exists, what is the use? You may be afraid. But if actions did exist, in parentheses, inherently, this doctrine would not be a prevention. Okay? So, if you think nothing exists, what's the use? Then, yeah, you may be afraid. Yeah, nothing exists. When I die, I go out of existence. That's terrifying, you know, for most people. Okay? So, he's saying, you who fear emptiness might be frightened by thinking if things lack inherent existence, nothing exists. So what's the use of striving for liberation? Because you're just going to get nothingness at the end. Okay? And so Aryadeva is saying, yeah, you might think, but think that. And so as a result, you might think, well, I don't like that nihilistic view, so everything does inherently exist. Then what he's saying, but if actions did exist inherently, this doctrine of emptiness would not be a prevention. In other words, if things were inherently existent, there would be no way to change them. And meditating on emptiness would be useless. Okay? And that is actually what we should be afraid of. Yeah? Okay. So if afflictions and karma exist inherently, samsara could not be eliminated by realizing emptiness, since actions and agents aren't feasible in the context of inherent existence. You know, if things are inherently existent, you can't posit there being a person that creates karma, an action of creating karma, how the process of creating the karma, what they use to create the karma. Because if things are inherently existent, it means they exist without depending on any other factors. Okay? Something that does not depend on anything else cannot change. Because to change, things need to depend on causes and conditions. But if you're saying that things don't depend on anything else, it means they don't depend on causes and conditions, which means nothing can change. Then you've really had it. Yeah? But then our experience is things change. So if things change, then they can't exist inherently. Because inherent existence, you know, you just have to think, if the inherent existence means independent existence, it means things don't depend on anything else. Okay. Now, can you think of anything that doesn't depend on anything else? Yeah. Can you think of something that doesn't depend on anything else? Sometimes we feel, there's this big feeling of I inside. I don't depend on anything else. I am me. I do what I want. I'm not dependent on anything. I exist. You have that sometimes, that feeling? Yeah? Okay, so we have that feeling.
Is a Buddha's existence dependent on us believing in a Buddha? Or the Buddha.
Wait, let's stay with what I'm talking about first before we get to the Buddha.
Okay.
So just because I have this big idea and this feeling of I exist, I am this independent thing, nothing caused me, you know? Okay. I have that feeling sometimes. Even I might even create a philosophy about it, saying I have this permanent soul that never changes, and that's the essence of who I am. But is that true? Do I exist without depending on anything else? You know? Well, no. You know, we got born depending on our mom and dad. We got educated depending on our teachers and principals and classmates, you know. We were influenced, we've been influenced our whole life by other things. Yeah, we're not some kind of independent, you know, entity that is under its own power. Yeah. If we were independent of everything else, then we wouldn't worry about anything. Because nothing could affect us. Yeah. But the fact that you have anxiety proves you're dependent. Yeah? Because if you weren't dependent, then you wouldn't be anxious about what's going to happen to you because nothing could influence you. Okay? So, you know, we did this feeling of, you know, this concrete I when we look at it. No, this feeling of being independent of everything, that's kind of ridiculous. You know, and even developing a philosophy about it is even more ridiculous. Okay. Now, what were you saying about the Buddha existing?
I was saying, at that level.
At what level?
At the level of Buddha mind, of becoming a Buddha.
Yeah.
What's the permanence they talk about, or are you just your own cause and disconnected from all other causes?
No. Buddha's mind changes. It's an impermanent phenomenon.
And what sustains that? What sustains it? What are the causes and conditions of
one moment of mind produces the next moment of mind. That's right. It. And then the Buddha sees different phenomena, since phenomena are changing every moment. What the Buddha's mind perceives changes.
What's so the connection? We have connections, right? I mean, it's empty of a separate existence. Right? So we're causing to create that.
Right. But Buddhas also depend on sentient beings. You can't have Buddhas without there being sentient beings.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There is a dependence there.
Yeah.
Even to that level.
Yeah, and Buddhas also depend on causes.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, everything depends. You know, everything that functions, that can produce effects, depends on causes, and everything exists in relationship to other things. Yeah, you can't posit things without this being this incredible mutual interrelationship. Okay, so that's what he's saying. Yeah, thinking the aggregates are truly existent is like thinking a mirage is water. Yeah, you can think a mirage is water all you want. Can you drink it? We can think our aggregates, our body and mind, are, you know, truly existent all we want. Can they actually function as if they were independent of everything else? No. You know. So you can see, I mean, how we're so filled with, like, wrong ideas. You know how we always talk about when you're in your 20s, you feel like you're invincible. You know, accidents happen to other people. They don't happen to me. Yeah. And then we grow up, and in our 30s and 40s, we kind of think that way too. Somehow, maybe in our 50s and 60s, we begin to think maybe. Yeah, if they haven't already happened to us. If they've already happened to us, then we think, oh yes, they can happen to us. I am dependent on causes and conditions. But as soon as we recover from whatever was afflicting us, we go right back to, oh, that horrible thing won't happen to me. I'm independent. Yeah? It's strange, isn't it? How many things we look at, you know? Well, that's not going to happen to me. How do we know? Yeah? All those other people who have whatever it is all thought they wouldn't have it too. Yeah? And sometimes it's even good things. We think, oh, that good thing will never happen to me. We dig ourselves into a pit. You know, that good thing will never happen to me. My life is just all good. You know? And then it does. And it's like, okay. So just what I'm getting at is, do you see the kinds of ways in which our thinking is conditioned by just blocking out the fact that things are dependent on causes and conditions? You know, how we just block that out time and time again. Yeah. In thinking, oh, this won't happen to me. Or also sometimes thinking, this will happen to me. Like when you were saying, I will wind up to be exactly like my parents, which is not what I want. Not realizing that there's causes and conditions involved, and we can become very, very different people from our parents. Okay, we did one verse. Any more questions?
I have a doubt. Uh-huh. Because I understand the dependent arising.
Mm-hmm.
That made me think that why not maybe it's real, the fact that you can be you can just be the result of all those causes. I cannot understand where the volition gets in. Because it's really like I am asking this because I hear what you say, and maybe it's just like a
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes we get this feeling of, yeah, I'm just completely caused. Yeah, aren't we? I'm just a result of all these causes and conditions. And then we start to feel really kind of weird, don't we? Yeah, because the sense of an I gets changed. Yeah, the sense of there's a me who's in charge here. That sense of self gets changed when we really feel, oh, but I'm just a bunch of causes and conditions. I'm just a result of causes and conditions. Yeah. So then your question is saying, where does intention, where does volition come in? Uh-huh. Yeah, that's, yeah. Because we're so used to feeling like there's this independent me that makes independent choices. Okay? Actually, and so we have this idea that volition can only exist if there's a concrete person who's making the choice or making the decision or having the intention. Yeah? And actually, volition exists very well without there being a concrete person who's making all these decisions. Yeah? But then we go, but then, what's making the decisions? I want to be in charge here. Yeah? And we begin to see that there's no independent person that's making the decisions. You know, like I can't just think, okay, tomorrow I want to speak Chinese and have that happen. Yeah. I feel like, oh, but there's me inside, and if I really will it, it'll happen. I can will all I want that I speak Chinese tomorrow, and I can tell you it's not going to happen. Yeah. So, yeah. So, but just the fact that there isn't a concrete person calling the shots, making the decisions, doesn't mean that there isn't a mental factor of intention, you know, that we are having intentions, and our intentions are also conditioned phenomena. Yeah? So our intentions are influenced by other mental factors, they're influenced by our experiences, they're influenced by the present situation and how it appears to us. So we can't point to any kind of independent intention or volition, because that too is conditioned, dependent. Yeah. It makes us feel a little bit weird.
You decide something. I cannot say, I cannot say, I am deciding.
Well, I can say I am deciding, but what is the I that's making the decision? I can't find some independent person who's in charge, you know? Like, you know how they used to think there was a little person, what was it in the...
Homunculus.
Inside our pituitary gland or something. You know, there was some little guy in there. If you open it up, kind of like Wizard of Oz, you know? Like behind, there was this whole presentation of the Wizard of Oz. And behind, there was somebody, you know, operating the lights and making it all happen. So we feel like behind everything, there's a me that's, you know, pulling the switches and making it all happen. Yeah? But there isn't some kind of person that we can draw a circle around and say, that's who it is who's calling the shots. All there is a person that exists by being merely labeled independence upon our body and mind. There's no other person besides the merely labeled one. Mm. Yeah. If that doesn't make you feel weird, you know, it's like, wait a minute, I'm not a mere label. I'm me. And then you say, prove it. Prove that I'm me. Prove that you're, that there's that concrete, independent person there. And then you say, yes, I'm going to find out who I am. And you search your body and you search your mind and you search the whole universe. And all you can find is a body and a mind and a label that was given by concept. That's it.
And is that mind the mind stream? Going after
yeah, well, yes, but also the mind stream isn't one solid thing either, is it?
No, because it's a stream.
Yeah, it's changing all the time, different levels of mind, and all sorts of things.
So being merely labeled, the basis of designation is continually changing.
Right.
The computation's placement.
Yeah, the basis of designation of the person does not stay static.
I had a question when you were talking about the 12 wins earlier, about karma. Because I've heard different terms like ripening karma, growing karma. So are there a lot like different?
Yeah, there's different kinds of karma. This is one of the things that I'm kind of hoping to talk about in some of the BBCs.
Okay.
Yeah, like the different kinds of karma that there is. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispel in the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kandiryataya Me. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful cleansing gets of generosity. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.